I am so excited about the opportunity to explore the wonders and potential of the human voice, and to do so with as thoughtful and gifted a writer as Elena Passarello, who is both a writer and an actor, originally from Charleston, South Carolina, who has extensively studied writing and done all kinds of writing, and done all kinds of performance on the stage as well, including some performances in some very interesting works. And maybe the most eye-catching item on her resume is that in 2011, she became the first woman to win something called the annual Stella Screaming Contest in New Orleans. And we hear a little bit about the iconoclastic cry of Stella from Streetcar Named Desire, and many other famous instances of the human voice being used in a really extraordinary fashion. The book, this collection of her essays, is called Let Me Clear My Throat. And the book is published by Sarabande Books, an independent nonprofit literary press that's been in existence since 1994. And for anyone who is interested in the human voice, both spoken and sung, as well as screamed and yelled and used in all kinds of fashion, this is a book for you to explore. I'm really glad I did. Elena Passarello, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Oh, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be talking to you.
So, you sort of start with that matter of Stella, so maybe that's where we should begin as well. The first chapter of your book is called Down in the Holler, and you have some very interesting observations about this famous, famous moment when that character, we think of Marlon Brando in the film, screaming, Stella. Tell us about the contest that you participated in.
Oh, sure. Well, I began the book thinking about my favorite vocal moments, and I think my favorite moment in the history of American vocal culture is Brando's 1951 Stella Scream. So I started researching it, and I discovered that they had this contest every year for about three decades down in New Orleans, in Jackson Square, around the time of Tennessee Williams' birthday, which coincidentally is my birthday. And so I told my publisher when we were talking about this book deal that I was going to go down there and I was going to win. But in my brain, I thought maybe I would go down there and lose and do a sort of George Plimpton-style, you know, narrative about entering and what it was like, and then, you know, losing is always much more interesting to a narrative, I think, than winning. But I had some bourbon, and I'm a little competitive, and so I ended up winning. There's an essay about winning in the book, too, and this a little bit after Down in the Holler, there's an essay called Harpy, which is all about the contest and what happened and why I did what I did.
One of the things you say about this moment, and I think you're talking about the film from the early, is it from the early 50s? I forget now, or the late 40s?
1951. Yeah.
You say that live man screams were not common in early 1950s feature films. It was rare to see any A-list actor this loud, this up close, this unafraid to look shamefully desperate in a movie. I'd never stopped to think about that. I mean, now that we have that with us, we sort of forget what a groundbreaking moment it was in film when it was first seen and heard.
Absolutely. One of the other things I think that makes it so, it really opened a door for sort of open feeling on stage with male, or I'm sorry, on screen with male performers. Cagney before him definitely was trying to bring the camera in closer, but for the most part, Brando was the first. And I think one of the reasons that we see such a full body, intimate portrayal, outward portrayal with his scream is because he had a year on Broadway performing the exact same role, making the exact same sound. I think he had plenty of time to connect himself, and so he's giving us more of a stage performance than an accepted 1950s screen performance.
You proceed from that to a very interesting chapter that, first of all, talks about this phenomenon of the scream, and you connect the scream itself to the very first moments of life, for most of us anyway. You write, most of us take our first gulp of air and immediately hurl it from our lungs in a scream. But then go on to say, From birth, our vocal cords work like fingerprints, telling the unique tales of our specific bodies. Explain to our listeners what you mean by that.
Well, believe it or not, there's been tons of research done as to where in the body the voice resonates. There's this beautiful book on the human voice called The Human Voice by Ann Karp that claims that some people think you can hear the sound of a broken foot in a scream. That you can hear, obviously, what parts of your sinuses or your lungs are congested. You can, we all, in the strata, they give women weeks of the month off because they think that their cycle affects their resonance. So it's more than just how wide you open your mouth or how hurt your vocal cords are that affects your sound. Many people think that the entire body does. Which I just think is so fascinating. They did another study once where they played an anthropologist who had some ties in Peru, or in a small Quechua Inca tribe in Peru, recorded his students in California screaming, imagining that their child was trapped under a car, or that they had just won the lottery, or that an alligator was about to bite their feet off or something, and then asked a non-linguistic scream, and then went to Peru and asked the people that lived in the Quechua Inca village to do similar things, switched the tapes, and with something like 68% accuracy, we were able to hear in each person's scream the level or the type of peril that they were imagining themselves being in. Like, people would go, oh yeah, that's somebody who's got a relative that's hurt, or that's a scream of joy. So a scream is a lot more telling, according to that study, than we would ever imagine as 21st century humans.
Hmm. You know, I just have to chime in here with something specifically sort of not related to your book, and yet it is. This summer, I had the really awful experience of encountering our normally gentle golden retriever, mm-hmm. having this summer scooped up from the presumed safety of its nest a baby rabbit, and heard this baby rabbit screaming in the jaws of our golden retriever, and it was incredible the way the sound just cut like a knife through me, and not just because I intellectually knew, oh my gosh, She got a rabbit. She got one of the baby rabbits. I mean, we always knew that was going to be possible, but I'd never experienced this. And the same thing had happened a couple of weeks earlier with our other retriever and a couple of the other rabbits in this den. But those rabbits were so tiny that they didn't yet have the ability to scream or the inclination, or I don't know. But but this baby rabbit was old enough to scream, and although it survived that experience, I mean, I don't think I'll ever get that sound out of my head as long as I live. And I suppose in some respects, the scream of a rabbit and the scream of a human, there is something connected between those two.
Absolutely. And you know, one of the things that's really connected is what's happening inside of you when you hear a scream. When we hear any animals are, especially mammals, are biologically built with this kind of emergency brake body part. We all have different versions of it, even birds do, that we are supposed to never really access, right? And they're this extra pair, for humans at least, this extra pair of vocal cords kind of on top of the regular vocal cords. And so we're hardwired to know that when somebody has enough air in their body to make that sound, animal or human or no, it changes the way that we hear it. It changes the norepinephrine in our brains, and it actually tenses the muscles in our bodies so that we know to either run toward or away from that sound. So the thing that you're not able to forget is connected to this major physiological response that you had that's connected to back when we lived, you know, in tribes in the veld, and we had to hear somebody from across a great distance if they were in some kind of peril. Mm. And that response, that emotional response, is doubled almost in terms of the hormones in your brain and the tension in your body when you recognize that scream as human.
Mm.
So just imagine.
Yeah, of course. Tell us.
And now, mm-hmm. now we scream at football games and Beatles concerts, which I think is so interesting. We've now put screams into parts of entertainment, but back in the day, they were fight or flight sounds that changed not only the bodies of the screamer, but the bodies of the people around them.
Mm. Tell our listeners why this chapter is called The Wilhelm Scream.
Okay. Well, the second I say in the book, this actually connects kind of to what I just said, is about this scream that was named after the second movie it appeared in. It's just a soundbite movie clip kind of a thing that was first in a movie called Charge at Feather River, and then it was in a movie called Distant Drums, where a character named Wilhelm opened his mouth to scream, and then they punched in that soundbite. And it's a weird little sound. It sounds a little bit like the Howard Dean scream to me. But some sound guys started getting hold of it and playing with it, and it has now appeared in well over 250 films in the past 50 years.
That exact scream.
Yes, and it's a crazy sound, very cartoonish. And so it's in A Star is Born with Judy Garland. It's in all of the Star Wars movies. It's in Howard the Duck. It's in Thank You for Smoking. Quentin Tarantino loves to use it. It's in the Lord of the Rings movies. It's fun. Once you hear it, you kind of can't get it out of your head, and then you become kind of like a bird call watcher. Whenever you watch a movie, you're kind of listening out for it. So, yeah, it's the sound of this man who's pretending to be dying, but we've used it as this sonic joke for 60 years. It's funny. I never thought of this, but it actually came. It was recorded the same year that Brando did his Stella scream.
Huh.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. The third chapter of your book is titled "How to Spell the Rebel Yell," and you are talking in this case about something that, in a sense, is just beyond our grasp, but something that a lot of people are very, very curious about. And since we have a very fine Civil War museum right here in our city, I really want to take a moment to talk about this really interesting phenomenon. First of all, tell us about this yell that we are talking about from the Civil War, and how sort of tantalizingly close we can come to actually hearing what in fact this was.
This is one of my favorite phenomena that I got a chance to talk about in the book, hands down. First Manassas, or the First Battle of Bull Run, which is one of the early battles of the Civil War, happened not very far away from Washington, D.C. And it was the first battle where the Confederates actually managed to sort of hold their own, and they ended up instigating a Union retreat. So it was a big deal. And in the middle of making that happen, it was a really confusing battle. People couldn't figure out who was who because the South and North uniforms were so similar. Stonewall Jackson's Stonewall Brigade made this sound as they charged down Henry House Hill toward the Union soldiers. And because it was so close to D.C. and because they thought this was going to be this merry little war, there were all these kind of D.C. bigwigs picnicking really close to the battle. They were going to watch it like it was a football game or something. And among them were many journalists, many of them English, and they couldn't stop writing about this sound that Jackson's men made when they went down the hill. And they called it things like shrieking and shrill and womanish, and apparently it was so terrifying, because we love storytelling, right? It was so terrifying that it caused this Union retreat. And then, of course, it pops up in other battles and other places. Ambrose Bierce says that he heard it, and it shows up in newspapers. We hear it at Chickamauga, at Second Manassas. But really, nobody 100% knows what it sounded like. Mm. But like all great sounds, it becomes sort of mythic more than it becomes real. And this is, you know, before recorded sound anyway. So you hear it sort of spelled out in these crazy bits of word spaghetti in newspapers and even in Gone with the Wind. And a couple sort of septuagenarian Civil War veterans tried to do it into microphones in the 1920s and 30s. And now we hear it mentioned in Billy Idol songs or in roller coasters. And but really, nobody knows what this sound sounded like.
Right.
We'll never know.
As you write about these two actual sound recordings, actually you say there are three of them, and two you can find online, but none of them can really probably come even close to actually showing us what this yell was like. At one point you write, regardless of whether these recorded throats served any real time on American battlefields, no geriatric veteran with his stringy diaphragm and arid larynx can make the same sound as a pink-lunged boy in 1861. Further, no resting body reverberates the same way as a body barreling downhill, heart bursting, tongue rotting in powder, carrying both itself and the nation into a new kind of warfare for the very first time. After hearing these two clips, it is easy to put to bed the possibility of the yell ever living on. That is, it is one of so many things in the world of sound that, in a sense, lives just beyond our grasp.
Yes. I think that's the most terrifying thing for people, too, to know that sound, even in this crazy world where we can nail down so many different things and keep them for posterity and put them in airproof chambers so that they won't decay, that sounds are so easily lost.
Mm-hmm.
Still.
Right, absolutely. It's one of the things I appreciate about public radio is that they have undertaken a couple of different projects to try to preserve certain kinds of sound that otherwise might be forever lost, that we just don't think about preserving. We are, of course, in the midst of a intense political battle across the country, so it's important for us to hear a little bit about what you say in the chapter called Communication Breakdown, in which you talk, among other things, about some of the wall-shakingly loud music that political candidates tend to choose for their campaign appearances, and about the now infamous yell by a certain presidential candidate named Howard Dean. Say whatever you like to our listeners about a couple of these interesting phenomena.
Do you remember the Howard Dean yell?
I do. It was. I have to tell you, about a week ago, I was interviewing a couple of political science professors about this campaign, and I was trying to talk about that, and I could not think of his name, but I could remember that infamous yell. And actually, they had trouble coming up with the name for a moment, too. And in a sense, that's a real sad kind of infamy, I suppose, when something really embarrassing or unfortunate you did lives on longer than your own name does.
Absolutely. I mean, that's what the essay is about, really, is how this random one-second sound recorded from a dubious microphone and broadcast from that dubious microphone could trump 48 years of service and medical practice and two very important years of campaigning, I guess Dean probably only did about 1 year of campaigning. It didn't just overshadow his presence, it erased him from pop culture memory. And I think, you know, until today, it sounds like this the same issue. Poor Howard Dean is still out there. He's still making stuff happen, but that sound just eclipsed him, which I think is amazing, amazing. But the Howard Dean essay, Communication Breakdown, is about that moment on January 19th, 2004, in the Val Air Ballroom in West Des Moines, Iowa, when Howard Dean made this noise and it was supposed to be this kind of rallying speech to his troops. He had just come in third in the caucuses, which was very unexpected. And so he was giving this, you know, rousing, you know, it's okay, we're going to go back and we're going to get all these other states and we're not going to stop till we get to the White House. He made this crazy noise. That this was 2 years before YouTube, but it still, I think, was one of the very first viral sound clips. It was played so much on network news that CBS and NBC issued a formal apology to the Dean team for saturating the media coverage with this inconsequential sound. And just like the rebel yell didn't really win or lose anything in the Civil War, the Howard Dean yell didn't really lose him the campaign. He became an unlikely candidate pretty quickly once voters started to get serious. But we like to think of this sound as the thing that lost him, right? That one second scream could lose everything, right?
Right, absolutely. Absolutely.
But the thing that I think is so interesting is that, and this is what I do in the essay, is that Howard Dean is the exact same age as, well, not to the day, but was born the exact same year as Alice Cooper, Steven Tyler from Aerosmith, Ozzy Osbourne, and the greatest of all rock screamers, Robert Plant. And then if you go to an early campaign rally, there are hard rock songs playing to rile the crowd up, because many of the most moneyed supporters of these candidates are also about that age. So we're allowed to have all this rock and roll screaming and yelling in the campaign arena, but we cannot hear a candidate make a sort of unbridled rock and roll sound. The sound that Dean makes is actually hits the same note that Robert Plant hits in Communication Breakdown at the very end, but we can't hear him sound like that, which I think is just a really interesting sort of impasse for human ears or American ears.
Fascinating. Your book talks about two singers that I want to make sure we just at least briefly touch upon.
Sure.
And one of them is someone that I know, since I'm a voice teacher and teach about opera. I know the name of Farinelli, one of the most famous of all castrati. And I think your book, an essay in your book, does a marvelous job of kind of explaining the intriguing physiology that we believe was behind the singing of the finest castrati. Can you just say a word about that?
Well, about the what it did to their bodies.
Right. I mean, in the or I guess what especially intrigues me is what do we know about the castrati and how do we know it? I mean, how does one study something that's even more remote than the rebel yell of the Civil War?
I know. Talk about a lost sound. We've seen the music that great composers like Handel invented for castrati. We have one weird record of an old Sistine Chapel castrati singing when he was quite old. But other than that, we have no idea what these gentlemen sounded like. We only know that they caused a major sensation. And these, of course, were choir boys who were altered so that they would not be able to hit puberty through some kind of veterinary castration practices in Italy. And what that did, because they didn't produce any gonadotropin in their bodies, they were able to keep their vocal cords quite short. The calcification of the bones is told to stop by gonadotropin, so that allowed their ribs to keep growing and expanding. So they were given these gorgeous big rib cages. They were very, very tall, and they had these little tiny tight vocal cords, which then they, you know, underwent extreme vocal practice. So they had these muscular, unbelievable facile and their vocal cords, and then this great resonant cavity to put air in. So, I mean, it must have been spectacular. And I guess the way that they figured that out was they looked at how castration or something like Kallman syndrome, general alteration of the male body, allows for the body to change, and they just applied that to the castrati. They also know that the castrati were tall and they had long fingers and that they were so strong vocally they could shake the walls of these European opera houses.
Let's finish out with none other than Frank Sinatra. And just we just have a couple of minutes, but I really was fascinated to see what you had to say about Frank Sinatra and the way in which he perhaps went about crafting the vocal technique that ultimately served him so well through one of the longest professional singing careers in recent history. Frank Sinatra is someone we sometimes think of as largely untrained. Apparently, at least at certain points in his life, he liked to sort of bill himself as largely untrained. But you point out that this is not the whole story.
Yeah, I think especially loud public figures that are allowed to be alive for a long time in the public record always contradict themselves, especially the big guys. And Sinatra was definitely one of those guys. He contradicts himself all the time. And for a long time, he would say, I never had one vocal lesson in my life. But then there's this weird little document. It was a 75-cent pamphlet released in 1941 when Sinatra was in his mid-20s and hadn't really become the Bobby Soxing balladeer yet. He was still a lead singer of a band. He released this little pamphlet called How to Sing Like Frank Sinatra that cost 75 cents that was made purportedly by him and his vocal teacher, John Quinlan, another opera guy, a bel canto tenor. And so this little pamphlet that you could buy for 75 cents, it's like 30 pages long, is sort of a watered-down version of bel canto training, and it is supposed to teach you how to make these beautiful, rounded crooner Frank Sinatra tones. And that's what the essay is about, is looking at those tones and trying to figure out whether or not that's something that Sinatra adhered to, and if other great singers that went up against Sinatra in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, if they followed the same practices.
Right. And one of my favorite moments in that chapter is when you are talking about a moment when Frank Sinatra underwent a little bit of vocal difficulty, and you write, at 35, smack dab in the middle of what experts call the peak of a trained baritone's ears, Sinatra was slapped with a reminder that singing is a gerrymandered bodily function. For all the research and methodology humans have applied to it, enough of singing's processes are still equal parts magic, blind faith, and worst of all, confidence. I mean, in a sense, that's why a book like yours is so valuable, because for all that we know and can know and continue to learn about the human voice and how it works, we still don't understand all of its intricacies and mysteries.
Do you find that that's the case as a vocal trainer yourself?
I absolutely do. In some ways, I feel like the more I know, the more I realize there is yet to learn. The book, again, is called Let Me Clear My Throat. It's a collection of essays by Elena Passarello. It's published by Saraband Books. Elena Passarello, I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation and very, very much enjoyed your book. And I really hope people will seek it out to learn more about the wonders of the human voice. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. This was a privilege. Thank you.